Again, in this session, I'd like to begin with a meditation. And as we did yesterday, to do a Vipassana practice, yesterday we were focusing on the body and looking at the three marks of existence in terms of impermanence, dukkha, no self. So what I'd like to do is, in this Vipassana practice, is focus on the mind, asking these same three questions. So initially we'll look at what is appearing in the mind. Is it impermanent? Then in the middle part of the meditation, is it in the nature of happiness or dukkha? And then the last part, is anything there the self or not? So let's do that practice first, and then we'll go back into the Satrantika text. We begin by setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. A vigilant posture is simply keeping the back nice and straight. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. Happily releasing them. Simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Again, allowing the eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And bring your attention to your own mind, observing your own mind and whatever mental events are arising in the mind. Without following thoughts, without trying to get rid of them. Simply be like an impartial observer or witness, observing them arise and pass, without grasping to them, without becoming distracted. Move from shamatha to vipassana by first asking the question, whatever is appearing in your mind, is there anything that is stable and unchanging, or is everything constantly changing? So observe your own mind in this way. now for anything that appears in your mind, you can ask the question, is there anything in the nature of happiness? Are any of these appearances in the nature of happiness? Or is everything in the nature of dukkha unsatisfactory? Now, for whatever is appearing in the mind, we can ask the following question. Is there anything that is the self, the observer, or is everything an object that is being observed? Let's go back to the text and on page 7. And I want to talk a little bit about this idea of isolates. We saw that an example of a false plurality was the pair isolate of pot and isolate of pillar. And then earlier we saw illustrations of affirming negatives, the opposite of non-thing, and the appearance of the opposite of non-pot to a conception apprehending pot. So actually this is how we understand things conceptually, is we understand them through the opposite of not being or not that. And that is what we mean by isolate. In fact, in the collected topics, when we talk about the isolate of pot, we're talking about the definition is that which is reversed from not being one with pot, or in i.e. non-non-pot. So to better understand what we mean by this isolate and how it really is the way which we conceptually know things, I'd like to read a little bit from, there's a book called Debate in Tibetan Buddhism, which borrows or uses a lot of these concepts within the collected topics, and particularly this topic about isolates. And there's a section in there where he's referring, he says, the purpose of identifying isolates. He said, with regard to the intention of identifying isolates, and now he's quoting the Lursa Ling, which is another monastic college, their collected topics text says, and he's quoting the text, it says, there is a purpose for presenting, for the presentation identifying isolates, because it indicates that there is a way of realizing objects by the power of the appearance of specifically characterized phenomena. So specifically characterized phenomena are phenomena which are appearing to direct perception. And a way of realizing what's called self-isolate. So self-isolate of pot is pot. And or illustration isolates. Illustration isolate would be if we have functioning thing, an illustration isolate of that would be cup and things that are illustrations of that thing. It says here, and a way of realizing self-isolates or illustration isolates by the power of the appearance of an isolate. And thus, in terms of objects, specifically characterized phenomena, all the impermanent phenomena we can directly perceive, are established as functioning things, and that the self-isolates and illustration isolates, which are equal to the enumeration of objects of knowledge, are imputed by thought consciousness. And now it says, he goes on to say, as explained by Khenpo Yeshe Tupten, the meaning of this passage is that functioning things, which are specifically characterized phenomena, appear to direct perceivers, to direct perception, together with all their uncommon characteristics, and that appearance is cast from the side of the object. Whereas isolates, which are permanent and generally characterized phenomena, appear to thought consciousness in a general way, and that appearance is imputed by thought consciousness. A direct perceiver realizes its object by the power of the appearance of a specifically characterized phenomena, and that awareness does not have to induce the appearance of its object. However, a thought consciousness may realize its object by the power of the appearance of an isolate, and that awareness must impute the appearance of its object, for the appearance is not cast from the object. For instance, an isolate appears to a thought consciousness contemplating table. It understands table through the appearance of that factor, which is a negation of non-table. Thinking about the colour of the table, the colour's isolate appears to such a thought consciousness. Also, in thinking about the shape, size, structure, and so forth of a table, isolates appear. However, there is a way of realising all of these qualities of the table apart from the appearance of isolates. That is, by the power of the appearance of a specifically characterised phenomena, the table itself. This is the purpose of identifying isolates, to indicate these distinct ways of realizing objects. Since the above passage from the collected topics explains that one way of realizing objects is by the power of the appearance of isolates, and hence thought consciousnesses understand their objects through the appearance of meaning generalities, these are generic images, one is led to wonder how isolates and meaning generalities compare. According to Kensa Yeshe Tupten, an isolate exists on the side of the object as a natural predicate of its being one with itself. And the meaning generality, the generic image, is what appears to the conceptual awareness. For instance, pot's isolate exists with the pot as a corollary of its being one with pot and thereby reversed from not being one with pot. And the conceptual consciousness thinking about pot understands its object through the appearance of a meaning generality of pot, which is defined as, so what a meaning generality or generic image is, the definition of that is, that superimposed factor which appears like a pot to thought consciousness apprehending pot, although it is not a pot. According to Demalocha Rinpoche, when one understands what one understands by pot's isolate is that factor which is a negation of non-pot and which exists with pot. So that's what's being said here in the text. Through the appearance of a meaning generality which is in the nature of elimination of all that is not pot, a thought consciousness understands pot. Thus, thought understands its object in a general way, for the meaning generality which appears to such consciousness is a superimposed factor which is mixed with objects at other times, places, and natures. The appearance of that image prevents thought from perceiving the actual specifically characterized phenomena. Rather, thought focuses on the isolate, understands the abstract rather than the specific object. Make any sense of that? Clear? Good. Very good. Yeah, exactly. So visually, you know, we see cup, colors and shape. Mentally, we understand cup, but that process is through the process of eliminating what is not cup. That process, that's how we come to know cup, is that sort of double negative. And that is what here is called, this is one of the examples of affirming negative, is the opposite of non-pot or the opposite of non-cup. So it's just describing the process of how we mentally know things that we perceive through the senses, through that process. Let's say we have, like, let's say a young child doesn't know what a dog is. And a young child sees a dog, and the mother goes, dog. And for the young child, maybe the young child sees something with four things sticking down and goes, okay, dog is thing with four things sticking down. And then he sees a table and goes, dog, because it matches. And the mother goes, no, table. So therefore it refines its idea of dog, that it's not only four things sticking down, but it has a thing sticking out the end and it sort of moves. That doesn't have anything sticking out the end and it doesn't move, so it's not a dog. Then the child sees a cat and goes, dog, dog, because it's moving and it's four things and it's something sticking out the end. And the mother goes, no, cat, cat. And then the child refines its concept. So this is how it's the opposite of not that, is that. Yeah. It's through that, it's through the process of understanding it's the opposite of what it can't be. It is that. That's the process that we use in understanding things. Okay. Moving right along then, the last point in outline four there is past and future are both permanent, present and thing are equivalent. So this is sort of the more standard way of understanding the three times, of course, different to the Vaibhashikas. So, of course, usually past is defined as that which has arisen and already ceased to exist. So that is permanent. And, of course, future is that which is yet to arise. So that's a permanent phenomena. And then present is that which has arisen and not ceased to exist. And so present and thing are equivalent, changing. So that's a fairly standard presentation of the three times. And then if we go into the next outline, the object possesses, like the Vaibhashikas, we begin by what is the illustration of the person. So again, if we can look at one of the initial charts, the Four Buddhist Tenet Systems chart, we see here that in the Sautrantika, some accept the continuum of aggregates to be the person. Some accept the mental consciousness to be the illustration of a person. If we go over the next page, it says that the example of first is proponents of Sautrantika who follow the Abhidhamma Kosha. So we see that in this chart here, that those Sautrantika's followers of scripture who follow Abhidhamma Kosha accept assert that the continuum of the aggregates is the person, whereas those who follow reasoning, Dharmakirti, talking about the mental consciousness being the illustration of the person. And then if we look at the next sentence there, it says, the definition of awareness is that which is clear and knowing. So here we have often sort of three terms that are interchangeable. Often we find these three terms, mind, consciousness, awareness, and often they are interchangeable, but we have to be very careful when we see these words, because often these words, particularly consciousness and awareness, can take on a more specific meaning in certain contexts. And particularly this word awareness we have to be very careful with, because here it's used as basically as mind. So here we say the definition of awareness, that which is clear and knowing. And often we say the definition of mind is that which is clear and knowing. But this word awareness, in different contexts, can take on different meaning. In fact, the definition here, that which is clear and knowing, the knowing in the definition is in Tibetan, rikpa, which is often translated as awareness. And also, this word awareness, particularly the Tibetan word rikpa, in the Nyingma school of Tibetan Buddhism, and also awareness in the Kagyu school, often in these two schools, awareness and mind are mutually exclusive. Meaning mind, often when they use the word mind, they often mean conceptual mind. And awareness is non-conceptual, the very subtle level of the mind. This, what's often called in Vajrayana Tantra, clear-light mind, primordial mind. So in those systems, often these two things are completely mutually exclusive. In fact, there's a text I studied that it says, distinguishing mind from awareness, to be able to distinguish these as two different things. So we have to be very careful when we see these words, and even this word consciousness can take on different meanings in different contexts. But here, in general, they're synonymous. So here, We see that the definition of awareness is that which is clear and known. So often we see the definition of mind is that which is clear and known. Question? But when they use the word mind, implicit, it means deluded conceptual mind. Implicit when they use the word mind. So in this definition here, that which is clear and knowing, as with many of these simple definitions, two-word definitions, often the first word is what's called the entity. And the second word describes the function. So, an example of this is often we find in these sorts of texts, you know, the definition of fire is that which is hot and burning. So what's the entity of fire? Is heat. That's its nature. What does fire do? It burns. So what is the entity of the mind or awareness or consciousness? It's clear, sometimes translated as clarity. What does the mind do? It knows. It is aware. So this word clear or clarity, of course, here implies two things. One, of course, is that the mind is not physical. And the other one is that the word clear or clarity implies that the mind is such. Clear or clarity means that it enables things to appear in it because it has the nature of clarity. Just like a mirror is clear, thereby it enables reflections to appear in it. Because the mind is clear or has clarity means that thoughts, mental images and so forth, appearances can appear in the mind. And then, of course, the mind functions to know, to be aware of those appearances. So that's the sort of the very simple definition here of mind or awareness in general. And then if we talk about two types of awareness or mind here, we talk about valid cognition and non-valid cognition. So a lot of this, all this presentation here that we're, in the next few pages that we're looking at, is really coming again through that subschool from Dharmakirti, from Dharmakirti's work, particularly also from Dignaga. All of this is really stemming from there. And valid cognition here, we'll see from the definition what we're talking about. It says, definition of valid cognition is a new and non-deceptive cognition. It says, in outlining the definition of valid cognition, it is necessary to mention the three, new, non-deceptive, and cognition, because new eliminates subsequent cognitions from being valid cognitions, non-deceptive eliminates correct assumptions from being valid cognitions, and cognition eliminates physical sense powers being valid cognitions. So taking the last one first, remember Vaibhashika do in fact accept the physical sense powers as being valid cognitions, as valid sense perceptions. So that is refuting the Vaibhashika's claim there. And non-deceptive eliminates correct assumptions as being valid cognitions. So valid cognition is we need to know things, whereas a correct assumption just happens to be in line with the truth, but it's not... it doesn't know the truth. So that's what this word non-deceptive means. And then new, here in Dharmakirti's system, which actually is different from what we see in Prasangika, we'll see in Prasangika next weekend, a valid cognition is necessarily a new cognition, meaning it's only really the first moment that is a valid cognition, and then every moment after that is what's called a subsequent cognition. Whereas in the Prasangika, they don't. This is the word in Sanskrit, pramana. And in there, it's here, it's the etymology is it means new. But in Prasangika, it just, they etymologize that as prime rather than new. So for Prasangika, the second moment of a valid cognition is also a valid cognition. Whereas in all of these schools here, including Satrantika, it's called subsequent cognition. So a valid cognition is only really the first moment. And then when it talks about two types of valid cognition, we have valid perception and valid inference. And valid perception is, the definition is, a non-mistaken cognition that is free from conceptuality. So any perception, any direct perception, of course, is free from conceptuality. So, of course, all of our sense perceptions are free of conceptuality. But also here we see that there are actually, and then, of course, in terms of valid perception, it has to be new and non-deceptive cognition that is free from conceptuality. Now, here in terms of non-mistaken, also we're going to see something a little bit different with the Prasangikas, because they say that all perception is mistaken. Because for them, things do not exist as they appear. And so every perception is mistaken with respect to the way in which things exist. But it's not mistaken with respect to the actual, the existence of that thing. So even though for Prasangikas, even though sense perception is mistaken with respect to the appearing object, it's not mistaken with respect to the object itself. So it can be mistaken and still be valid sense perception for Prasangika. These schools know. Because for this here, this school here, of course, is things do appear as they exist. So it's not mistaken with respect to its appearing object. And then there are four types of valid perception here. There's the self-cognizing perception, sense perception, mental perception, and yogic perception. So here we have this self-cognizer that the Vaibhashikas don't accept, that the Sautrantikas do accept, and some of the other schools also do accept and some not. So again, to have a look at this self-cognizer, that we can look at the definition. It's a new and non-deceptive cognition that is free from conceptuality, is only inwardly directed, and bears the aspect of an apprehending subject. So remember, this is posited as to how the mind knows itself. So maybe to read from this Tennant's book that we read the other day about, just to refresh our memory about this. Those who follow Dharmakirti, the Sautrantikas following reasoning, and it's also talking about two other schools, the Chittamatrans following reasoning and the Yogacara Svatantrikas, contend that our subjective consciousness is also an object of consciousness. That is, the mind is itself known at the same time that it knows its object. Otherwise, they argue, we could not remember not only the things we experience, but our experiencing itself. that we can remember our own seeing, hearing, etc., is broadly accepted. This is on page 70. Those who dispute self-consciousness or self-cognizer, those who say self-consciousness exists say that the mind is like a lamp. At the same time it illuminates other things, it illuminates itself. Those who dispute self-consciousness use a different metaphor. Mind is like a measuring weight. It cannot measure itself at the same time it measures something else. So therefore, or say the Prasangikas, it is like a lamp, but since the very nature of a lamp is illumination, it does not act upon itself to illuminate itself. But how, other than self-consciousness, can we account for the memory of subjective aspect of experience? Except for the Prasangikas, other schools account for memory of consciousness itself by the mind's ability to perform introspection, which observes a mental state, but a moment after it occurs, as with any other object. So that's how the other schools who don't accept self-cognizer, they say that it's our introspective ability that we can know the awareness itself. Whereas here, they posit this self-cognizer, which operates simultaneously with apprehending the object and is only inwardly directed. And then valid sense perception. Except Prasangikas. Well, as it said here, because what we said here in the text was that because it's in the nature of illumination, it uses the same metaphor that it illuminates itself. And so it's no need to posit a self-cognizer. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That it's through introspection that we know the mind, a later moment, not simultaneous. Introspection, yeah. Okay. Then the valid sense perception here is the definition, is a new and non-deceptive cognition that is free from conceptuality and arises in dependence upon a physical sense power, its own uncommon empowering condition. So in the next three definitions, we talk about this empowering condition. So remember, we had, for consciousness to arise in general, we need three conditions. We need three conditions for consciousness to arise. We need an observed object condition, an empowering condition, immediately preceding condition. So here, when we talk about this valid sense perception, we say that it arises in dependence upon a physical sense power, its own uncommon empowering condition. So therefore, if we are talking about a valid sense perception observing the cup, the empowering condition would be the eye sense power. The observed object condition would be the cup, and the immediately preceding condition would be the immediately preceding moment of consciousness. Those three things come together, and then in the next moment, we have a valid sense perception of observing the cup. Similarly, when we talk about valid mental perception, it says it's a new and non-deceptive cognition that is free from conceptuality and arises in dependence upon a mental sense power, its own uncommon empowering condition. So the mental sense power, when we talk about this, is the mind itself. is the mental sense power. So then these two are basically the same in that case. But there still has the same three conditions. And remember we said that for mental perception, for a normal person, we only really talk about that one moment of direct mental perception that comes at the end of a sense perception, and then in the next moment we have the conceptual mind apprehending that. Although, of course, we can talk about valid mental perception in terms of clairvoyance and so forth, and knowing other people's, and knowing past lives and remote viewing and so forth. They are valid mental perception, direct perception. No, the eye sense power, eye faculty. Whatever the consciousness that is, the mind that is present at that time. So that could be, let's say, it could be that we're thinking about something. So whatever the moment of consciousness that is manifest at that time, when you contact the object, those... Yeah, the moment that is present at that time, whatever that might be. Of course. So what that moment of consciousness is engaging in could be anything. But we need a moment of consciousness there, and then together with the observed object and the sense power, those three things come together. And then the next moment, a consciousness is generated observing the cup. And also, of course, and this is a little bit later, coming later, we talk about this inattentive awareness as well. And then similarly, we have the valid yogic perception, an exalted wisdom that directly realizes subtle impermanence or either coarse or subtle selflessness of person, independence upon a meditative stabilization that is the union of shamatha and vipassana, its own uncommon empowering condition. So here we see that for yogic perception, we're talking about directly realizing here either subtle impermanence or the coarse or subtle selflessness of person. So the coarse selflessness of person, of course, is realizing there's no unitary, independent, and unitary, independent, unchanging, unitary, independent self. Or subtle selflessness of person, realizing there's no self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So that yogic direct perception comes through the union of shamatha and vipassana. So this is what's called a wisdom arisen from meditation. So the empowering condition enabling us to have that direct realization of here selflessness or impermanence, the necessary basis is that union of shamatha and vipassana. So now, of course, if we meditate, we may have a little taste or experience of impermanence or selflessness. So that's not a yogic perception. That is simply a little taste or experience of impermanence or selflessness. To actually become a yogic perception, a direct perception of that, we need a very stable mind. We need the mind of shamatha. And then on top of that, we need to unify that with vipassana. So even though, let's say we've developed this very stable mind of shamatha, then if we go into vipassana practice, that investigation will destabilize our shamatha a little bit. And so it's often said at that point we should alternate, that if it destabilizes too much, go back to shamatha. So we're sort of alternating shamatha vipassana. But then as we deepen that, at one point then, our Vipassana practice will not destabilize shamatha, but it will enhance shamatha, and they will become unified, union. So that's what's talked about here, the union of shamatha and Vipassana. And with that union, then we can, even with that union, as we're going to see next weekend when we talk about emptiness, we achieve that union of shamatha and Vipassana on the path of preparation. So when we're moving, remember those five paths, maybe we can bring out our last chart, the Mahayana path chart. And if we look, and of course this is related to the Mahayana of the Prasangika, but we can draw a parallel here. If you look at number four at the bottom there, number four says, union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. So, and that marks the entrance to the path of preparation. So in the Prasangika system, of course, we're realizing this emptiness rather than selflessness as the vipassana practice. And we unify shamatha and vipassana when we get to that point of the path of preparation. But even though we've unified them there, the realization of emptiness is still conceptual. So we haven't yet come to a direct realization of emptiness. So this yogic direct perception that realizes, directly realizes emptiness only happens then at the start of path of seeing. So even though we have a union of shamatha and vipassana prior, we still haven't got to the direct realization of emptiness till the path of seeing. So that's the sort of the parallel to here. So of course here in the Sautrantika, we don't really talk about emptiness, we're talking about selflessness of person as the vipassana practice. So there are three types of this valid yogic perception: impermanence, coarse selflessness of person, subtle selflessness of person. Any questions? So yogic direct perception, of course, has to have a basis of shamatha vipassana. And then the object or what we're realizing will vary depending on the school. Yeah, sure. Okay. Any last question? Otherwise, it's time for lunch break. And then we'll jump on to the inference and the non-valid cognitions in the next session. Okay. Let's break for lunch. Are we...